Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is fantastic to have you here for another episode of the show. Now, I am super stoked today because my guest is Australia's most decorated female Paralympian, Ellie Cole, who cemented her place in Australian sporting folklore by winning her 17th medal at the recent Tokyo Games. So Ellie, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang with us. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. And just as a side note, Jesse, I'm still not used to hearing, you know, most decorated female Paralympian. Something to get used to, I think.
Let me ask about that, because do you consciously think about records, 17 medals, or is that something that just happens over time? Do you reflect on that? What's the thought process?
You know, I think Tokyo is very interesting for me because I was going into those games unaware that I was even going for that record. And it wasn't until I think 5 days into the Tokyo Paralympics where the CEO mentioned that I was about to break this record.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it wasn't something that I was certainly aiming for, but I've given so much to Paralympics and Paralympics have given so much to me. So to be able to have my name down there as someone to beat in the long term, well after I retire, is pretty nice.
Yeah, it's a wonderful achievement. Obviously, it's a huge achievement, clearly. 17 medals is massive. And I heard Kurt Fernley say to you that anything more than 13 is just getting greedy, or words to that effect, which made me laugh as well because there's clearly a good bit of banter there. But I wanted to ask you about, you know, being conscious of those achievements as you went through. Your first Paralympics, I think, was Beijing in 2008. And I think you won a silver at that particular Games. And I was listening to an interview, you said you felt this expectation of turning that silver into gold. I'm just curious to understand how conscious you are about those milestones, those markers, and the process of setting those goals for yourself.
You know, you are right in saying that, like, when you win a silver as a young athlete, you are very conscious that you feel this desire to turn that silver into a gold. And it's kind of, I think, the way that athletes are brought up through the system, where you train from such a young age to be a champion. And once you reach that pinnacle, you'll always be a champion.
Yeah.
And it was something that I'd always strived for. I remember training for the London Games and trying to win my first gold medal. And I was so focused and I let nothing get in my way of my training because I wanted to stand on the blocks in London and know that I had it in the bag. And that's not an easy position to put yourself in, you know, being so confident that you can win the race because there's so many variables that can affect your performance. And I think I was a little naive thinking back to how much a gold medal was going to change my life. I thought that it was going to fix everything that I felt about myself having a disability. And I thought that everybody was going to, you know, want to be my friends. I think I was holding on to so much trauma from what had happened to me when I was younger and my experiences growing up through school that I kind of thought like a gold medal was going to fix everything. And it was wonderful to win, but I put so many things out in my life just in a box and kind of put them under my bed. And I missed out on a lot of experiences when I was younger. So I always reflect back now and think, was all of that worth missing out on those experiences of being young and being at high school? So yeah, sometimes I agree it was worth it, but other times I don't. So it's fascinating, like being a 17-time medalist, because I feel as though I am so happy in myself and the effort that I've put into my swimming career that even if those 17 medals weren't there, I would be still so proud of what happened in between all of those races.
I work in the business world with dentists, and there's a sense that, you know, when I achieve this, I will be happy, I will be fulfilled, I will feel better about myself, people will feel better about me, whatever it is. And I wanted to ask you a bit about that experience of, it sounds as though, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds as though you attached a lot to winning that gold medal. And it's obviously been a thing that's brought questioning and consideration into your life. What do you say to people who are thinking, I'll be happy when, or I'll be successful when. What does that mean?
You know, I feel like no matter what industry you are in, those thoughts are always going to come into your mind. As I mentioned, being a young athlete, that was reaching the pinnacle. And I saw people like, you know, Ian Thorpe and Grant Hackett, who I grew up watching on the television, winning gold medals. But then I would see their lives fall apart after. And it was kind of in the same period after they had retired when I was winning like my first gold medals, where I saw the damage that could have been done if you didn't take care of yourself as a whole person. And yeah, I guess I came at a bit of a crossroads where I started questioning why I was holding on to something so materialistic. For me, I think that was really challenged as we were training for Tokyo, because COVID came along and I was trying to train for a Paralympic Games for swimming in an apartment, of all things. And I kind of had to just finally let go of that expectation of myself. And I started working on supporting the athletes through that time and creating some really wonderful relationships with my Paralympic team. And then when we finally arrived in Tokyo as a team, honestly, I was just so happy to see that the athletes had pushed through together and arrived in Tokyo together. And I won no individual medals in Tokyo. I won two relay medals. And I took away from that experience so much more than I ever did winning medals. So, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of, I'm finishing up my career just questioning everything.
Yeah.
And I've told all of my friends who are athletes, Olympians and Paralympians, that I've found so much more enjoyment on trying to be a good person before an athlete. And I'm walking away from my swimming career with 17 medals, but I'm very proud of like the relationships that I've made through swimming and the mentoring that I've done through swimming. And the medals aren't even a consideration to me. And I'm reflecting on that.
Yeah. It sounds like it's a common experience, I imagine, for athletes who have, I guess, very distinct careers. You know, one career comes to an end and you embark on the next phase of your journey. What do you think that success has taught you? You've obviously experienced success at the highest level. Everyone knows who you are. You know, you go down the street and everyone goes, oh, there's Ellie Cole. What do you think success has taught you about life in general?
Well, that's a great question. I feel like success has taught me that nothing is linear. You know, you have a plan, and when you're thinking of your goals and your dreams, you kind of think of yourself at the beginning or the middle and how are you going to get to the end. And you don't really consider all of the ups and downs that go along with chasing a dream, whether that is injury, whether that's financial stress, whether that's motivation. And I've reflected on my swimming career. It's been very successful, but I feel like the times that have been successful make up about 1% of my swimming career. And the other like 99% have been like failures that I've learned from, or have been like huge challenges that I never thought that I would be able to get through. Although on the outside, my career has looked quite successful, I think it's because I've gotten up time and time again. Like, I've been on the swim team now for 17 years. So of course I'm going to win a lot of medals in that time because I've been around for so long. But in those 17 years, I've had way, way, way more failures than success. So I think it's like a consistency over intensity kind of mentality.
Again, I think there's a lot of translation there from sports to the world of business that I operate in. But let me reverse the question then. What did failure or difficulty or challenge teach you? What did you learn about yourself?
Like, the word resilience gets thrown around with Paralympians a lot. Yeah. But in all honesty, like, it has taught me how to be very resilient. You know, for example, in the gym yesterday, I dropped a weight on my foot and I thought that I'd broken it. And I've broken my foot before. And I remember I dropped the weight on my foot and then I jumped into the pool and put a pool boy in because I was like, I might as well finish training. And then I remember saying to my coach yesterday, because he was stressing out, we're only about 6 weeks away from our nationals, And I said to him, I was like, we've still got 6 weeks. It takes 6 weeks for a foot to heal. I've done this before. I know how to do this.
Yeah.
We'll be fine. And I remember thinking, like, when the first time I broke my foot, I was an absolute lost cause. And I was like, okay, the second time that it's happened, like, I've done this before. And I feel like COVID threw so many punches at us as athletes and at everybody. And it's amazing how I'm responding to incredible challenges now than I did compared to 2 years ago. Like, you know, something gets thrown at me like, oh, I think I've broken my foot. And I was like, it's all right, we can find a way around this. And I think, you know, that's been the biggest lesson that failure has taught me time and time and time again, is that I've had so many failures that when something happens to me, I just kind of let out a bit of a sigh, like, here we go again. Like, how are we going to get through this? And then I make a plan almost instantly on how I'm going to get myself out.
It's really funny that you say that, because I was watching the tennis the other week with Ash Barty at the Australian Open, and gee whiz, I can't remember whether it was the final or the semi-final, but she was up against, I'm forgetting who her competitor was at the time, but this particular competitor was, you know, really putting up a good fight. And interestingly enough, the commentator was talking about, you know, Ash Barty's not panicking here. She's gone into problem-solving mode. She's thinking about how to strategize her way out of this, which sounds like a very similar thought process that you've gone through as well. And I think over the last 2 years with COVID, it's been a bit of a ever-changing, you know, ever-moving kind of situation. Just what was it like preparing for the games that were meant to be 2020, delayed to 2022? How do you manage your, you know, peaking and all those sorts of things when the time frame is a little bit uncertain? How do you go about that?
In terms of the time frame for Tokyo, everything was exactly the same. It had just been pushed back exactly 1 year. And so most of our World Championships, Commonwealth Games are around about in September, August, which is when the Olympics and Paralympics is anyway. So we kind of follow a very structured training program and a very structured taper program. And so it was basically all of that was unchanged, but it was more for us, I think, the mental struggle of training so hard for something that may never have eventuated. And that was the difficult moments for us because, you know, as a swimmer, you've got to think we're pushing 200 heart rate for 45 minutes to an hour, getting to the point where there are buckets at the end of the lanes in case we need to throw up into them. And when you have a solid goal in front of you that is getting closer and closer and closer, those things are much easier to do because, you know, you have a time limit. Whereas with the Olympics and Paralympics being so uncertain, I caught myself questioning in those really hard times in training, like, why am I doing this? Because I'm pretty convinced that these games aren't going to happen. But then I would think about what my competitors were doing. And I was like, there is no way that my competitors are going to be dropping the ball. And so, I kind of used, like, that's when we really used each other in the Paralympic team, the Australian Paralympic team, to kind of check in on each other and say, like, come on, we've got to get there together. And I think that, like, community spirit kind of got us through to the finish line.
Wow. That's amazing. Funny you should say that. I had a chance to talk to another athlete a little while ago, and he had a photo of his competitor on the ceiling of his bed. So every time he didn't want to get out of bed in the morning to train, he'd wake up and see his competitor and go, oh, they're out there training, I better go out there too.
It's a good tactic. I used to do something similar where I had, when I was a young girl, I had my competitor's time on the side of my desk, which my bed was next to. And so, yeah, when I woke up in the morning, I would see her time straight away. And it was very motivating, let me tell you.
Ellie, I want to just go back to the London Games, if we can, for a second, because what I'm curious to understand is that confidence. You said you wanted to kind of prepare so well that you felt really confident going into that race. So I wanted to understand the role of preparation particularly, and the role that preparation plays in confidence. I guess what my hypothesis is, if we prepare well enough for something and we put in all that preparation, the results pretty much take care of themselves, or we can let go of the outcome a little. I'm wondering if that translates to your experiences or not, and I'm curious to understand what that preparation looked like. And then I guess the follow-up question from that is, how do you build a race plan, and how do you then execute that race plan? Because again, I've heard you talk about one of the greatest joys was having a race plan and executing it the way you intended to. And so I'm curious to understand that as well.
Well, heading into the London Games, I was an AIS athlete. So I trained at the Australian Institute of Sport, very close to you. And, you know, I was so fortunate to be in that environment because I had so many world-class staff around me and experts who would pretty much make decisions for me as an athlete. And then my job was to execute those decisions as best as I could. And at the time in when I was training for London, I was so intent and focused on beating a rival of mine that I had never even come close to. And so every training session I would get in and I would think of Natalie Dutoit and I would train very hard. And I honestly did everything that I could. As I mentioned, when I stepped on the blocks in London, I knew that I was going to win that race. I knew that I was fit. I knew exactly what I had to do. And when I dived in for my 100 meter freestyle, it's almost like my body just went on autopilot. I didn't think anything. My body just knew exactly what to do. And my mind just completely switched off. And it was an incredible experience that I've never really had again of that autonomy. But when we're thinking about how we're going to do a race plan and execute a race plan, it's a lot of trial and error. And so in the lead up to a games, we will enter maybe 6 or 7 competitions in that year where we will practice the race plan and we'll try and get everything right down from stroke counts to stroke rates to splits to stroke length. And we have all of this data that's given to us at the end of a race and we kind of find where our weak points are and like graphs and everything. And in saying that, at the same time, we're also trying to practice a lot of that race plan in our training. And so we might do a lot of 25 meter dive practices where we're trying to get our first 25 meters exactly right. And then we'll do turn practices where we're trying to get the 5 meters into the wall and the 10 meters out of the wall exactly right. So that, you know, your coach can say to you, I want you to swim 50 meters in like a 48 stroke rate with this amount of strokes and I want you to hit this time. And you can usually hit that time within like 0.1 of a second.
Wow.
It takes that much practice.
Wow.
I struggle to do that these days, but when I was younger, I was a very good athlete and I was very disciplined. And it's funny now that my body's changing and everything's getting a bit tighter and less strong. I am struggling to do it as well as I used to. And I don't recover as well as I used to, but I'm still enjoying it. So
just wait for the next decade, Ellie. I'm just going to tell you straight up.
I know, like I woke up this morning, I just turned 30 and the last 3 days I haven't been able to weight bear on my right leg without my hip cramping. And I was like, oh God, it's arthritis. I think I'm getting arthritis already.
I've got 20 years on you, Ellie, and clearly I've not had the sporting career that you've have had or anything close to that. But, yeah, it sucks.
It's all downhill.
I'm just going to say it out loud. It sucks, right? Dear. Hey, Ellie, I wanted to just go back to the beginning if we can. I know I'm bouncing around here, but there's lots of really fascinating parts to your story. And again, I want to ask you how you got involved in swimming in the first place. I'm aware that when you were little, you had cancer and that's how you lost your leg. Is that how you got into swimming in the first place from a recovery therapy point of view, or was it something you were doing before you were ill? How did you get into swimming and what kept you in swimming?
Well, I never swam before I lost my leg, really, just kind of playing around in the pool. But I started swimming for rehabilitation. Like swimming's a great sport because it reduces the impact that it has on your bones and you can kind of float and you can learn how to coordinate your body movements again. So yeah, when I lost my leg, I had to learn how to walk properly. I had to learn how to use my new body and swimming was a really great way to be able to do that. And I was going around in circles for a number of weeks.
For real?
Yeah, I was. And then I started swimming in a straight line because I have a twin sister. So she was doing these rehab sessions with me. And, you know, I'm not sure if you've ever seen like a young child go through physical rehab, but most of it is fun, designed as fun and games, but you're actually learning. And so I really enjoyed the environment from what I've been told. And I loved the water because, you know, when you wear a prosthetic, especially as a young kid, you run around a lot and they're not comfortable. And in swimming, I'm able to take my prosthetic off and I feel the same as everybody else. I'm not limited by what my prosthetic can and can't do. And it's kind of just me and the water. and I loved it. So I just kind of kept going with it, and I'm still going 27 years later.
So what's kept you going all this time? Because that's a long, long swimming career and an enjoyment of a sport that clearly has grabbed you in a way. What's about swimming that you really love?
I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that question. I've thought about why I love swimming so much, and, you know, I'm always at a bit of a war with myself, because I said last week that I hated swimming and that I was going to give it up. And then this morning I was in the water and I was like, oh, I just love swimming so much. And so I have good days and I have bad days, and I have more good days than I do bad days. And so I keep going back, and I always feel so good after I go for a swim. And I don't know, I honestly do not know what I love about it. I don't know, the people that I've grown up with in swimming, they're my people. And in Tokyo, I was fortunate enough to see the next gen coming through, and they're my people. And I don't know, just I love everything about it.
Yeah,
but sure. I don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah. That's totally cool. What do you say to the next generation of swimmers coming through? What, you know, I heard you referred to as nanny goat a little while ago. What advice do you give the younger swimmers who are coming through about their career, about life, about everything?
I always speak to the young swimmers about that success and failure model, because when you're young, it's quite easy to do personal best times because your body's growing, your body's maturing. And then when you hit around about 20 years old, those personal bests don't come as often. And in fact, I haven't done a personal best time since 2015, so 7 years. So for me, I always make sure that they know not to measure their enjoyment based off their success and based off their times. And, you know, if they're finding that they're not enjoying the sport because of outside influences, like say as an athlete in swimming, you're very influenced by your coaches, you're very influenced by your parents. And a lot of the times as an athlete, you go down roads that have been decided for by other people. And I found myself in that predicament a number of times, and I found myself not enjoying the sport and pushing through because I felt like I had to. And it took me to take a step back and reflect on exactly what was in front of me and what I wanted. When I mentor the young athletes, I just make sure that they're doing it for themselves and for nobody else. We see athletes in like Ukraine, Russia, America, who are all forced to be good athletes from such a young age. And there's so much time and money invested into them that you can just tell when they lose the love for it and they're doing it for other people. And it's really heartbreaking to watch. And that's why when Simone Biles at the Tokyo Games said, "I'm taking care of my mental health first," like she put herself first on the biggest stage in the world. Mm. And I thought that was incredible.
Massive courage.
I think the times are changing, and although, you know, it's heartbreaking that she had struggled so much up until that point, it was so wonderful for her to stand up and say, like, I'm putting myself first. And
It's interesting you say, I've got my youngest daughter's a competitive gymnast, and so Simone Biles is her pin-up girl.
Yeah.
Forever. I think, you know, every gymnast in the world, you know, looks up to Simone. But it was a really interesting conversation we had around our dinner table, actually, about that particular event. And we're talking about, and again, my daughter's not in that same category of athlete by any stretch, but it was a really interesting conversation about the importance of doing things for yourself and taking care of yourself. Because at the end of the day, I mean, that's all we've got is our own health and well-being, you know, when it kind of comes to it. In terms of self-care for yourself as an athlete, what do you do to take care of you? How do you recharge yourself? Because you've got incredible training schedules, you've got, you know, commitments around media and commitments around other things. What do you do just to kind of go, you know what, it's Ellie time? What do you do to look after yourself?
Well, I actually schedule in time in my calendar to make sure that I have like a day off every week or every 2 weeks, because as you mentioned, my training schedule is very busy, as well as my manager keeps me very busy. And, you know, having to do that and then adulting at the same time. Like, actually, oh my gosh, I can't believe how much time cooking takes up during the day. So in my like Microsoft calendar, I literally have like day off, and I make sure that I don't book anything on that day, so that when I come home from training at 8 o'clock in the morning — it's usually on Tuesdays and Thursdays I write day off, because I don't train in those afternoons. So when I come home at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'll have my nap, and then I have the whole day to do whatever I want. And it's been an absolute game changer. It's just a bit of a mental recharge that you need, because it's so easy to have, you know, requests flying in or competition schedules get really busy, and you kind of just say like, oh, I've got an hour here, I can fit something in there. And I feel like, yeah, a lot of people are trying to do more and more and more, especially as like the internet and access to people increases. And yeah, they don't really just take a step back and do something for themselves. So anyway, that's a new initiative that I've implemented into my life in the last, actually, it's like my New Year's resolution.
Okay.
And it's been the best New Year's resolution that I've ever had.
Hey, let me ask you, do people try and impress on those boundaries, or are you pretty firm with those boundaries?
I'm pretty firm on those boundaries. Yeah, I'm pretty firm. And like, I always have time for people. But, you know, that's usually Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, every other week.
Yep. Fair enough.
And, yeah, I always will make time for people, but sometimes, you know, someone might have to wait 2 or 3 weeks before I can go have coffee with them, because I'm not doing it on my day off.
Yeah, and that's fair enough too. So on your day off, what do you do? What's fun and relaxing for you? How do you recharge?
It's honestly whatever I feel like doing. So like, I really enjoy — I've got two dogs, so I really enjoy driving them to like a park or like somewhere beautiful and kind of just sitting out in the sun. I never see the sun because I'm always training, napping or working. And I don't think you're going to like this answer, but I find it really enjoyable on my days off to like clean my whole apartment.
No, you don't need to explain it to me. I am the total neat freak. I'm with you.
Yeah, I feel like it just helps with my stress if everything is in order and everything's clean. And while I'm doing it, like, I listen to podcasts or I listen to music, and I like, my mind switches off, and I take a lot of enjoyment out of making something better than that was when I got there. And cleaning, like, it might sound ridiculous to some listeners, but cleaning is honestly something that I do really enjoy doing. And so I'll either like cook a new recipe I've never done before, I'll clean, I'll take my dogs for a walk, I'll read a book, I'll watch a movie, like whatever I feel like doing.
Fantastic. Well, actually, it's funny you should say that, because as I said, I'm a neat freak. But for me, if I've got tidiness around me in my physical environment, I feel a real sense of mental order that comes with that as well. It's really weird. I don't know how to describe it, but I feel more relaxed when my physical environment's tidy and clean than my — I don't know.
I think it's like an anxiety thing. I'm the same. Like, if my partner was renovating our kitchen a couple of months ago, and there was stuff everywhere, and I was so tense all week, and I just didn't have a good week because I was like, I can't deal with this. No, so I totally get that. And I actually have the same experience with when it comes to exercising and healthy eating. Like, if I don't exercise, my eating goes out the window. Like, I'll start snacking on like chips, or I'll start eating like pizza every night. But then as soon as I'm back into training, like, I don't know. Yeah, discipline. So it's kind of the same with cleaning and, yeah, the mental order.
I love that. Ellie, as we start to wrap up our conversation, firstly, thank you so much for coming to hang out with us. It's been a lot of fun to talk to you. As I said, I've seen you on so many different things around the place, and it's nice to get to talk to you. What I wanted to ask you about, just as we talk about competition at the moment, on the interview with Kurt Fearnley, you and Kurt talked a lot about the Paralympics coming into their own, and how they've always been a great games, but now people are starting to understand and appreciate them perhaps more than in the past. And I wanted to just, I guess I wanted to get your thoughts and perspectives on that, because I love watching the Paralympics. I love watching the Olympics. I love watching, you know, I love watching a two-up game. Yeah, I love watching any sporting competition of any variety. But I wanted to ask if you could just share your experiences of how you've seen the games evolve over your time as an athlete, and what you're hoping for the future as well.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. As we're winding up, he just throws in a massive question right at the end. Hey?
Yeah, so my swimming career, I started the I was introduced to the Paralympics in like 2004, like the Paralympic world. So that's what, 18 years ago. And I've seen it change quite considerably in those 18 years. When I was beginning my swimming career back in 04, 06, 08, they were so segregated. I'm even surprised that Paralympics was under the Swimming Australia umbrella, if I'm going to be completely honest with you, because it's like, it's honestly like we were a different sport. And for us, you know, we were invited to the national championships, which we should have always been, it should have always been that way. But the way that the scheduling was done in our national championships back then, we had the Paralympic events at the very beginning of the schedule and at the very end of the schedule so that they could work like the television prime time with all of the able-bodied events. And so we would have to get there ridiculously early for our competition. And then we would have to stay all morning and race at the end of the heat session. And then we'd be up first in the final session. And it was just, it wasn't working. But it's just, they would say to us things like, you should be, you know, grateful that you are at this national championships. Whereas, you know, now it's wonderful. Like we have Amazon as a broadcaster. Network 7 actually, I believe, changed the game for Paralympics. Network 7 was the first commercial television station to show the Paralympic movement, the Paralympic Games, and also the Commonwealth Games with the Paralympic events in there on television. And it kind of introduced people to the Paralympics because, you know, people aren't sitting in their living rooms actively searching for Paralympic races on their computers. Like they're just like most people that come across Paralympics for the first time are just channel flicking. And so we started being on Channel 7, and then other television stations started to notice that there was an appetite for Paralympic sport, just as like there's an appetite for women's sport and how quickly that's growing.
And what a revelation. Who knew, right? Seriously, why did it take? Isn't that a no-brainer?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the people that were running like commercial television or media were all like at that time, like just men, no offense, like white men who just assumed that everybody in the world wanted to watch men on television and that, you know, women didn't even watch sport. And that's not the case at all. Yeah, it's been amazing to see like that shift in perception of people wanting to watch Paralympics. But like I said, also that appetite there. And then once people get to know the Paralympic stories and how incredible they are, they become invested in the athletes. And yeah, it's for me being a Paralympian and seeing that change, like I've seen the conversation around disability become so much more open than it was when I was younger. Like disability, to speak about disability in the 90s was a bit of a taboo topic. Like you just didn't speak about it. And now like people are openly talking about it and it's conversations that need to happen. In fact, well, I was somewhere yesterday and someone just came up to me and said, what happened to your leg? Like, and they were just genuinely curious. And I was like, you know, 10 years ago, they never would have said that. They would have pretended like I had two legs and I don't have two legs.
So Ellie, what are your hopes for the Paralympics and how do you see the future of the games going and where do you think it should be?
You know, in Tokyo, we just saw a pay parity, which is, I think, a bit more significant than most people realize, because as a para athlete growing up through the system, I was always very much underfunded and I very much relied on the bank of mum and dad. And the opportunities for me just weren't there like they are for the able-bodied pathways. And so even just that simple act of, you know, more government funding, pay parity for the athletes to be able to support themselves to be full-time athletes is going to make such a difference. Like the sport is already so professional, but we have had to push up against so many barriers along the way and jump over so many huge hurdles that we shouldn't have had to jump over. And so to be able to have that government recognition and that support, young athletes with disabilities are going to grow up through the system and have so many opportunities that we just didn't have. And so like I'm so excited to watch the games, particularly as we head into the Brisbane Olympics and Paralympics, on that investment that's going into young para athletes. And the limit hasn't quite been reached in para sport yet on what, you know, a human body with a disability can do. And it is so different from person to person and varies from disability to disability. So I'm really excited to, yeah, see where, what happens just based on that support from people. And for me to answer, where do I hope it's going to go? It's a world that's so unsure to us right now that I can't really put an answer onto that. But I'm going to be watching with very eager eyes at what happens next in the Paralympic space, and I'm so looking forward to the Brisbane Games.
Well, I think it's going to be fantastic to have the Games in our countries again. It's going to be wonderful. Ellie, you've obviously achieved so much, and firstly, congratulations on all the things you've achieved. But what I've really taken out of the conversation today is your deeply reflective nature of your career, your life, where your sports fits into your life, understanding as part of life, and reflecting on what's brought you joy in your life. And clearly swimming has brought a lot of joy, but it seems to me that looking outside of swimming and maintaining those relationships and supporting others is a really important thing for you. And it feels to me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it feels to me like there's another chapter there ready to go in terms of supporting others on their journey as well. So what does the future hold for you personally?
Well, it's very exciting because I'm ending my swimming career at the Commonwealth Games, which is only a few months away. But, you know, like you said, that chapter in like being involved in swimming and being involved in sport certainly isn't closing. I'm very excited to stay involved in sport in a different capacity than being an athlete. I'm not entirely sure what that looks like yet. It's kind of just slowly unfolding itself, but I'm so keen. You know, you see a lot of athletes retire from the sport and they want nothing to do with it, and that they decide to come back and give back to the sport in their 50s and 60s, whereas I know that I'm going to be ready to jump in straight after I finish Com Games.
Well, I think the sporting movement in general and the Paralympics in particular and swimming in particular will be all the better for that. So, Ellie, you've been a wonderful guest today, and I just want to say thank you to you for coming onto our show and sharing of your experiences and letting other people know what you've been able to achieve and how you've been able to achieve it and all the lessons that come from that and all the life learnings along the way. So, again, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang with us today. You've been an absolute gem.
Cheers. Thank you for having me too.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.